Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, how you doing?
Good morning, sir. I am doing well. I had such a good time last night at that Tie Atlanta event. Wasn't that? The food was good. The company was good. I learned a thing or two about venture capital, so I thoroughly enjoyed that. But I just like visiting with everybody. It was like old homecoming week, wasn't it?
I know. There were people from the Metro Chamber. There were a lot of people from the startup community and a lot of VCs. So did you chat with Sig Mosley any?
I did, just a very little bit, and talked to, Nancy Wright Watley from the Chamber was there, the incoming president, Karen Robinson something. Yep. I mean, she is just full of energy.
Yeah, that's a great event, and everybody should check out Tie Atlanta. They're a great business organization. Anybody in business here in town should know what they're up to.
And Lee and I are going to be at every event. Hopefully that doesn't scare you off. But we're going to do a remote broadcast. They've got a big powwow like in April sometime.
That's right, TyCon.
And we're going to be on site interviewing folks.
Yeah, so, excited about it.
Shout out to those folks. They're doing some marvelous work. But so are the folks in the studio. This is going to be a fun segment.
I know.
A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Martina Stelmazek. She is president and CEO with GACC South. The G, as I remember, stands for German. I forget what the rest of it stands for, but we'll dive into it in a little bit. We're also going to get a chance to visit with Kip Caffey. He's managing partner with Cary Street Partners, and they've got some exciting news. There's a recent acquisition there that I think is going to be a lot of fun to talk about. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the CEO and founder, the Grand Poopah, for an organization called Preparis. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Armstead Whitney. How you doing, man?
Hey, it's great to be here today.
Well, we are delighted to have you. What are you preparing us for?
Well, if you look at the world today, there's a lot of things that can impact businesses, people, communities, weather events, natural disasters, cyber attacks, terrorism. The list of threats just seem to keep growing. And businesses in particular, you know, they really run the economy. They employ the world's global workforce. And it's a critical mission to keep them up and running no matter what happens. And so what we do is we help businesses protect their business, their people, and their brand by using technology to solve a big problem.
And then, but what is the big problem? You say up and running. What is that defined as? Because that can have that can mean many things.
Well, it can. And every business, you know, has to serve their customers no matter what. You think about Hurricane Sandy, there were, you know, hundreds of law firms, for example, based in lower Manhattan, and they needed to stay in business to continue to serve their customers, access their files, continue to
answer the phone.
Answer the phone.
Do basic things, right?
Absolutely. And if they can't do those things, take a law firm for example. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not able to serve their customers, and their customers may go elsewhere for those services. And so there's a real importance that businesses really don't have anybody looking after them to help them keep running. And law firms, banks, credit unions, asset managers, retail, all the same. That it's just not a core competency. That if these threats happen, you know, what do I do?
So what do they do typically? Like panic?
Panic. That's the first thing they do.
You know, it's interesting. We spent a lot of time with businesses that go through events, and what we found is most businesses have a couple pieces of paper that are in a binder somewhere that's supposed to tell them what to do.
Do they? And it's like some laminated sheet you pull out for emergencies?
It is, and it might be dated 10 years ago. And I was one of those people. Actually, the genesis for Preparis started because I was the president of a media company in New York City over 9/11, based in Midtown. We had 200 people, and I had one of those binders. And let me tell you, when I'm trying to find my people, serve my customers, keep my shareholders happy, we did not do that for several weeks, and we lost business.
Right.
And so really, we started Preparis as a way to help businesses overcome those things.
So now, but so typically what happened? Like you say, there's a binder or something. What's in that binder?
Well, the binder, you know, most businesses today will have some things in there that focus a lot on IT. You remember Y2K,
right?
And a lot of plans focused on disaster recovery if our networks and systems go down. But then you go to the next level, which is really your people, your operations, your continuity. It's really business continuity to keep the business running. The things that should be in those binders are what to do when certain threats occur, who's in charge, who calls the shots, where should people go if they need to leave the building,
right?
What redundancy should they have in place from a people and a process perspective. And really, it's if you start thinking about it, it's a lot of information. And so to pull out a binder out of the shelf that you've never read before and try to follow that is very, very challenging.
And then you might not even be able to get to the office, though, to
That's
find
exactly
the binder.
Right.
Right?
And that happened a lot. You know, Hurricane Sandy, it happened a lot in some of the other weather events. There's no doubt that you need to be able to have something dynamic and online and on the web, and that's what we do.
So the binder would be good reading after you're already snowed in and you don't have anything that you can't do any work. So read the binder and catch up.
And
on
let me
that.
Tell you that the binder is exciting stuff. I mean, it's eye-catching material.
So now, when you're having these conversations with your prospective clients and clients, this must be, you know, this is like talking to the insurance guy, right? The life insurance guy. These are things they really don't want to talk about, isn't it?
They don't want to talk about it until a couple of things. If you're a business that's regulated, like a bank or a credit
right,
union,
they have to have this.
You're required by law.
Right.
And what's happened is the SEC reviewed about 40 firms that went through Hurricane Sandy and reviewed those binders and said, hey, you know, those things don't really work real well. You need to do some new stuff. And that new stuff plays right into what Preparis does. So that's a big growth market of ours is regulatory.
Anybody that's regulated that has to do it, you right. have a better system to do it that's a lot easier than what they're currently doing.
And it's not a core competency. A lot of these companies don't have a full-time person who's
right.
an expert.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's where we come in.
So speaking of coming in, you come in, and first of all, you've got a team of folks walking around pointing out all of our vulnerabilities.
They have a binder. They have a Preparis
no,
binder.
No, these guys are way past the binder. But first, you got to see what you're dealing with, and you're identifying all these vulnerabilities and building. I mean, all these plans would have to be pretty customized, wouldn't they?
Well, what's interesting is the first thing we did when we started Preparis is we realized we were not experts in all these threats. So we went out and created a team we call the Preparis X-Force. And the X-Force is a team of about 30 experts from things like cyber, pandemics, radiological threats,
right.
food
zombie
illness.
Apocalypses,
yeah.
All the important ones.
Entire spectrum.
And we also have relationships with weather experts like the Weather Channel who bring us expertise there. And we took those experts and we said, you know what? What should these companies really have in their plans?
Right.
And we took that expertise and packaged it into a web-based product that changes over time. So now cyber is a big thing. We have a lot of cyber experts that are now putting content out and recommendations and training. So what we do is we take that expertise, and first thing we do is we say, hey, let's assess what you have in place today. Mm-hmm. And we have some online tools that help them do that. And then we say, okay, what is your core business that you're in? And we connect some tools to that business that enable them to complete their plans, make them dynamic. We put them on the web, and those plans can be accessed from any web device, tablet, mobile phone when they need them. We then have tools to let them train on the plan. It's kind of an online education system. We have the ability for them to access threat information on over 200 threats. So if you get a bomb threat, a white powder in the mailroom, an office creeper, someone you're not, you know, what do you do as a business?
Right.
And those threats are in there written in a way that businesses can understand. And then we have an emergency notification system that once you need to take action, you can blast out the correct instructions to all your employees and make sure they take action. And all that's just kind of wrapped into an elegant interface that no matter what your role is in the company, you can access this information and take action. And that's what our clients are doing.
So now, is there a person, like who's in charge of this?
You know,
typically,
yes.
The hall monitor.
Right. Like,
well,
is it the CEO? I mean, is the CEO the guy that hits the button that disseminates all this?
No, the CEO is responsible for the brand of the firm, communicating with shareholders, the integrity of their services. It's interesting, in our sales and marketing efforts, we have this little thing around the office where we try to find Steve or Stephanie at a company. And Steve or Stephanie are people who usually it's a part-time job where they've been anointed the responsibility to build a business continuity or preparedness program. And we sympathize with them because they have piles of documents and binders. And we say, you know, hey, Steve and Stephanie, here's a much better way to do this,
right.
Like a Salesforce.com
so
automation.
Is it tool. An HR function? Like where is the operations, I guess?
It depends on the industry. We work with over 60 law firms worldwide, and that'll usually reside under operations. For banks and credit unions and investment firms, it's always the IT side, so VP of technology.
Right, because that's the most critical thing for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and they'll report up to compliance. Mm-hmm. So it depends, but usually after about one or two calls or emails, we find who Steve or Stephanie is, and then we just introduce them to our product in a new way to solve a big problem.
So are they pretty receptive? Does that work pretty well in your arena? You can pick up the phone or send them an email or a postcard or something, and they'll at least have the conversation?
Well, it has to be targeted. We use a lot of automated marketing software like Pardot. So we use a lot of that type of technology to identify those potential buyers. And we also use a lot of education. I mean, face it, most people don't like talking to salespeople. So we do educate them on here's a new way to solve this problem. And they attend webinars. They download great white paper content. They're engaging with us on social media. So we really have a process of educating first, and then we sift through and those that are most interested and raise their hands are the ones we focus on.
Now, and you must – they get a lot of reminders because it seems like almost every day you're reading the newspaper that something happened to somebody, you know, whether a firm lost, you know, a lot of credit card numbers or there was a natural disaster that happened. So those things are probably always out there that are – people are thinking, wow, we dodged a bullet there. You know, they're having those kind of thoughts.
Yeah, the world today is just riskier. There are more things happening, and also social media. If a company doesn't handle something properly, it gets out there really, really quickly, and can really tarnish their brand and their revenue growth. So yeah, we definitely use what's happening in the world as a way to educate the marketplace.
Now, what you said you were with a media company in New York,
correct?
How did this pivot from now being the CEO of this company, which is a kind of a technology, which seems like kind of a far bridge? How did you make that transition?
Sounds like a backflip, not a pivot to me.
Well, I've been involved with innovative companies that have been in software, technology, and services for 25 years. That media company was a digital media company where we own the rights to a lot of the world's media archives like CNN, National Geographic, MGM, and license those to third parties through a web portal. And so this is a very similar type of model, which is take an antiquated industry that really has had no automation or innovation and create a living, breathing service, a SaaS service, on the web. And so applying, you know, new tools to an old industry is really the way to go. And then subscription model. So it's easy for people to get started. No matter what size your business is, it's really easy to get prepared and get prepared.
Now, can they, once they kind of become familiar with you, they can play around with it online? Do they have to interact with a person, or is this something they can just do on their own just through your website?
Yeah, it's mostly on their own. We have a lot of interactive training modules so that, for example, if the hurricane's coming, there's a 30-minute hurricane training module in the system. You can also test your plans by downloading some testing tools, get people in a room and say, okay, we're going to simulate a blackout today or a cyber attack, and go through that as a team. If they do need us to help them really rewrite their plans, we have a great services team that'll come in and review those plans and customize them. But all that all ends up on the web. So even their plans will end up in our systems. They can access those from any internet connection, mobile device, or tablet. So it's very much an automated play, you know, highly scalable. We have, you know, thousands of we're protecting thousands of businesses in over 200 cities worldwide, and technology really is the only thing you can use to help you do that.
So what was it like early in the cycle, getting this thing off the ground? Did a lot of people embrace it very quickly, or was it an uphill battle at first?
You know, you talk to any entrepreneur, it's never easy. you hit your head against the wall 20 times, and you eventually break through. Believe it or not, our first customer was Equifax and locally, and they're still a great customer. And we got a meeting with the COO, and I didn't even have a business card at the time. And I said, look, here's our vision for Preparis. And she said, we'd like to be your first customer. And so even today, they have 4,000 employees using our product, and they're just such a great partner. And so, yeah, it was a lot of early meetings and defining what we do and the vision. And I was very active in the sales process for the first couple years. And now we've got a great team that's kind of taken the reins.
So now that's a great lesson for entrepreneurs, though, is to find that big partner that can really jumpstart the company, right? Because it would have been a much harder path if you had gone to a smaller company and got them as a first customer, right? Having an Equifax as a first customer, that helps credibility, that helps roll out. You have a big customer right off the bat that can help kind of fund the company, in essence.
You know, there's no doubt. You brought up a good point. I talked to a lot of other CEOs and entrepreneurs of technology companies. A lot of them are not as sales-driven as they need to be, that the product is really there to serve a market need, not the other way around.
Right.
And so the key is get a handful of early adopter customers that know that they're early adopter customers. And what I said to Equifax is, look, we're going to spend a lot of time and attention with you. We're going
to
make this work because you're my first customer.
We have to.
And that's what happened. And so, yeah, you really have to be – patient, and you have to go out and say, look, let's build the business around a core group of customers. Once we really learn how they buy and what they want, then scale it from there.
Right, and that was great that Equifax was open to this, because a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, would be too intimidated to even approach them, because you're like, look, this isn't fully baked. We kind of think this is how it should work, and we're going to make some mistakes. But you found a partner that was open to that, going through the learning curve with you. You were able to make it attractive for them, right?
I think it's a testament to their culture of innovation as well, that as you get your first customers, you've got to match innovation, you know, with innovation. So your service or your product is innovative and new. You got to find early adopter customers that embrace innovation for their competitive advantage. And that's how they look at this, as another way to fulfill their mission to stay up and running. And so that was a good match early on.
So you're rocking and rolling now. Everything's working well. You've got a great base of customers. What kind of priorities do you have in place for 2014?
Well, we doubled our customer base last year, and we'd love to see that continue. I think our priorities are really twofold. One is we're really looking at financial services as a big growth market. You know, there's 15,000 banks and credit unions out there, and they have to do this. So, you know, that's a big market. Also, we're getting close with the insurance industry. You know, where they're interested in bundling Preparis with their business insurance that they offer their customers. So signing up a couple big strategic partners is critical, and I think we've got a few teed up. Another industry is the security industry. So security companies manage buildings and provide security services. We're a great add-on to those services. So I think this is the year of continued, you know, double growth, but also find a couple great partners to help us bring even more customers.
Now, if you were going to give some advice to companies out there that don't have this kind of continuity plan, what would you share with them?
I would say don't wait, because whatever you have in place during the time of that event, it will dictate how well you respond. And we see that time and time again. So just get started. Just get the team together and say, look, we want to put a program in place. Preparis.com has a lot of free tools and guides and you know, content that can help them get started. It's a culture thing, too. Just, hey, get started. And that's really the best place to go is culture.
How do you prioritize which disaster to kind of plan for? I mean, like if you're based on the coast, I could see, you know, storms, hurricanes, those kind of things make sense. But like if you're in Kansas, your hurricane program may be different.
It's only one page.
You have a tornado program there. But, you know, like how do you prioritize what is the biggest thing to worry about?
Well, we take what's called an all-hazards approach, which means we don't know the exact threats that are going to impact you, but if they do, and these are the types of things that are impacting your business in a certain way, here are the steps to take. But you think about a global company, they've got offices all around the world.
Sure.
Yeah, we had clients in Japan during the tsunami. We had clients in Europe during the volcanoes. We had clients in the Middle East when tanks started rolling through from the protests in Egypt. And you've got everyday emergencies where there's weather closings and pipes and all that break, and you got to navigate people to your office. So we have an approach that no matter what the threat is, you're going to have the tools and the training and the people to make it through.
And you guys have a real commitment to education, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation. And I understand you have in the works a webinar of some sorts for threats associated with 2014. 2014 kind of threat report type thing. Talk to that.
Right. We every year we come out with a sort of a threat report or threat forecast, and we're having a great webinar on February 6th, and you can sign up at preparis.com. It's at 2 p.m. And we have representatives from the CDC, the FBI, cybersecurity. We have a weather partner that's going to be there, and it's going to be all about these experts sharing what they saw in 2013 and the trends that they're going to see in 2014. It's a widely publicized event. It's free, so anyone can sign up and join. And it's really a once-in-a-lifetime experience to hear all these experts in one place. So we're very excited about that.
Now, this continuity plan, I would imagine if you're with Preparis, then you don't have to worry about this as much because yours is a software as a service. So you're constantly updating and giving me the best possible protection. But if I have the binder, how often should I be revisiting that plan?
Yeah, I think at least annually you should revisit the binder and get your team together, review your protocols and your best practices, but also most importantly test on the binder. Mm-hmm. And go through a simulation, say, hey, we're going to practice today a cyber threat or a blackout, and just get used to it, because business people, this is not what they do. This is they have to step into this role with having no perspective or context. But if you practice and practice on it, you'll get a lot more confidence, just like anything else.
All right, let's get some coordinates. Where can our listeners go to learn more, maybe have a substantive conversation with someone on your team about setting up some sort of assessment or initial consultation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's preparis.com, P-R-E-P-A-R-I-S.com. And we've got a lot of tools, information, videos on our product. We also have this little great thing called a Yeti. He's a little snow monster that's there that'll kind of guide you along the way. He's kind of our Geico chameleon. But we're a very passionate group. We're very passionate about what we do, and that'll come through when you visit our site.
Well, I am so glad that you came to the studio this morning. I'm not going to lie; I'm a little bit nervous now about our own lack of preparedness here at Business Radio X. But this is important stuff. This is not something we can neglect. And I want to have you come back sometime. I think it might be an interesting conversation if you were to come back with a client, maybe like a local client that you've been working with, and maybe hear from their perspective how they have grown in their ability to be prepared and protect their assets and their people. I think that would make for an interesting conversation sometime. What do you think?
We would love to do it, and we have a lot of clients that would love to do that as well.
Fantastic.
Do you have the Equifax guy here in town?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the team is here in town. And
would they be up for that? Because I would just want to know, learn about how an enterprise that large would partner with a startup, basically, and
yeah,
take a shot.
At that angle, too, that'd be interesting.
I mean, I think that what you did is fantastic, and I think more entrepreneurs should take that tact of finding that big partner, because that can make all the difference in the world. I mean, it's a startups are a risky business by itself, but having them in your corner kind of makes it a lot safer bet, huh?
Absolutely, and I think there could be some good lessons learned for your audience about that, and we'd be happy to set that up.
That'd be great.
All right, one more time, let's leave them with coordinates, website, email, whatever is appropriate.
Yep, preparis.com. It's up for you to take a look at and look at all of our great content and tools, case studies, and we're very passionate about what we do, and would love to get our listeners there and check us out.
Now, is that a webinar free, or is there a fee for that one?
It's a free webinar.
Wow.
February 6th, 2 p.m., and we'll have the sign up shortly on the site. So,
yeah, no excuses not to check that out.
That's right.
Fantastic. Hey, listen, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
I'll be here. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Yes, sir. And we're going to leave your mic open because you might have something smart to say during the rest of these conversations, too. So hang in there with us. All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio Show, we have with us President and CEO of the German American Chamber of Commerce of the Southern U.S., Inc., which is why we often just say GACS. I don't know. Please join me in welcoming to the program Miss Martina Stelmasek. Hello there.
Hello. Great to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Did you learn anything in that last segment?
Yeah, a lot. Actually, we do have one of that binders.
But you should check out that webinar.
Yeah, I already made a note of that. You know, I'll tell my HR person and anyone else. Yeah.
So this is really a sales meeting for you. This is the whole thing with orchestrators, so you could sell something.
I'm always selling.
So, tell us what you're out there trying to do for folks, Martina.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So we're part of an international network of 120 offices in 80 countries. So we support German business interests, in our case, in the southern U.S. So it's 11 states from North Carolina all the way to Texas, and also Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So, we are the official representative of German industry and trade. So we kind of serve the role of the trade commissioner. Germany doesn't have a trade commissioner like other countries do. So this is why they just always had the chamber system, and this is why we also have that official role. We're also a membership organization, and we are here to support German companies that just want to get started on the U.S. market.
So now, you work with companies that are in Germany that want to work in the United States, or do you help companies here in the United States that want to do business in Germany?
Actually, both. So, but our main focus is German companies that are either, just looking to do business here in the U.S. or companies, German companies that are already here and that are maybe thinking of expanding or changing locations.
Right. So there might be a German company that's in California, mm-hmm. and then you can educate them about the mm-hmm. South.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I personally have a great deal of affinity for Germany and the German people. My wife speaks three languages, English, consultant, and German. And so when we go to Germany, we're able to communicate more effectively, really, than we are in London. But share with us, if you will, some of the specific services that these companies and the people leading them are asking for.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much anything from do I even have potential on the U.S. market?
Oh, okay, so that early on. Okay.
Yeah, so that early on. Then we support in finding business partners such as sales reps or distributors. But we also help them find the right location. So if a company is really looking at a manufacturing site, we also help them, you know, with finding that site.
Are there a lot of businesses from Germany that are here in the South?
Yeah, there are around 1,500 German companies in the South. And of those around, well, I think the latest number from the Georgia, you know, official people mm-hmm. is 426 German companies in Georgia.
So how do you spend your day when you're not, you know, a big media star and you're out there just kind of doing your day-to-day thing? Like you'll meet with different companies. Give us a day in the life of Martina, if you would.
Yeah, there's probably, you know, we have a staff of 30 people here in Atlanta. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's not just me doing, you know, supporting all these German companies. And we do have a branch office in Houston, Texas, with another 10 people. So my day is probably, yeah, I do get inquiries from German companies, which I then usually forward to the right people within our office, because we really have people that are experts on site selection or experts on finding business partners. So for me, it's more about, you know, building the network. Also a lot of I travel to Germany quite a bit also to educate people about the South, because probably, you know, the South doesn't come to the mind of people when they first think about the U.S. So maybe it's more New York, Chicago. So it's also a lot about, you know, all the opportunities that the South has to offer to German companies. So I do that a lot, or just, you know, in general talks. Right now, one of our big focuses is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, which Germany is definitely in favor of. So I'm also doing a lot of talks here in the U.S. and trying to, you know, what is it? What is in it for companies? Why should people support it? Why is it important?
But there really are a lot of reasons that Atlanta and Georgia should be attractive to foreign investment, including Germany. Right,
right? It's a lot less expensive than New York.
Exactly, yeah. It's just, you know, that when you're just in probably larger companies, you know, or when you're in a specific industry, the South is maybe more at the forefront. Let's say automotive. I mean, if you're a supplier and you're a supplier to BMW and BMW is expanding their production, you know, you have a good reason probably to go to the South. But it's more mm-hmm. the smaller German companies where, you know, maybe they just want to open a sales office, and then probably Atlanta or Charlotte or, you know, whatever, any of those cities probably just doesn't come to your mind at the first thing.
So now, so you're constantly getting inquiries from German companies? Like every day are they inquiring?
Every day.
Wow. So like you have to respond back? And what's a typical question they're asking you? Like what's the first question a company asks you?
It can be anything. You know, sometimes it's also just a problem. My container is stuck in customs. What do I do now?
Uh-huh.
You know, or Volkswagen wants me to be one of their new suppliers. How do I get people over? So it's, you know, it can be starting out like that.
Uh-huh.
So, but then, or it can really be they heard me or one of my employees talk in Germany, because we do a lot of those seminars also in Germany about market entry into the U.S., and then it's about, well, we heard you talk, you know, tell us a little bit about the U.S. market. What should we be aware of? How can you help us?
There's a real theme here across both conversations of educating the constituencies that you're trying to serve. So, I mean, you've got a really robust website, because I went and I did my pre-interview research. But, I mean, you really do. You've got all kinds of information on there, various kinds of reports and what's going on. So someone on your staff is investing a lot of time in collecting and disseminating that information as well. Huh?
Yeah, definitely. No, educating is definitely a big part of it, which is sometimes also what we really try to stress with German companies, because sometimes they underestimate the U.S. market. With, like, let's say Asia, you know, it's a different language. I mean, people look different, you know, you really go there and feel it's a different culture. And here with the U.S., it's sometimes, oh, I've been to Florida so many times on vacation, you know, I know English from high school. So it's kind of, you know, they don't really grasp that it's still a very different business culture, and you should really put a lot of research into before you go and make that investment and go to the U.S. So this is also what we're educating a lot about.
So now, I want to go there for a minute, because you spend time in Germany, you spend time here. Share with us some of the observations that you have about just the differences in the business culture in Germany and here in the U.S., if anything comes to mind.
I mean, I think the one thing that probably most also know is Germans are very direct. I mean, this is also what we have to tell some of our employees, you know, the German employees, don't be that direct. You know, people will get offended here. And also, I mean, Americans tend to be very nice and super enthusiastic, you know, so Germans walk out of meetings sometimes and think, yay, I have that deal, you know, tomorrow they'll sign. It's like, you know, it's not that easy. or German sauce, you know, they go a lot into this history and, you know, like, oh, this is 100 years of our company history. And here it's really more, well, what is it now? You know, what can you do for me now? Not what did your grandpa do, you know, 100 years ago. So it's sometimes also how you structure meetings, go into negotiations.
So you help them in all that? That's part of your responsibility?
Yeah, we do that, yeah.
Wow.
What a fantastic service. I think that's terrific. So tell me about this. Do you actually say GABO or G-A-B-O, this Georgia
German-American
Business Outlook?
Yeah.
Tell us about that and what the results were and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we do that with our colleagues in Chicago, New York. These are the other two big German chambers. So it's a business survey that we do every year in the fall, and we survey around 1,900 German subsidiaries that are already here in the U.S., and we ask them about how is their business going, what do they expect for the coming year, what are some of the, you know, challenges they face. So actually we found that German companies are as confident as they, you know, never were. We're now doing it for the fifth year, and it really hit a five-year high record of confidence. So
really? So even though the economy, I mean, it seems like we're in an upswing, but the German companies feel really bullish about what's happening?
I mean, we saw that all over the past 5 years, that German companies always felt that their own business was going better than the U.S. economy in general.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, really, 98% of German companies think that 2014 will be a great year for
98%.
them. 98%?
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's great. And, you know, when people think that, then it's true.
Right, exactly. Well, you're almost there.
No matter what's really
there.
Going on externally, if 98% of the people think it's going to be a tank year, then that's what happens, right? I mean, so much of it relies on that.
So now, what is the challenge that they see then? Like if 98% are bullish about this and confident, then what is the challenges that they see in dealing with the marketplace?
A lot of them really want to see, you know, stability with a fiscal situation out of Washington. Tax reform, that's one of the issues.
So kind of macroeconomic things are more of an issue than the micro. In their community, they think they're going to kick butt wherever they are.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
So really, it's really more, macro. I mean, the other big thing is really skilled workforce. And this is also for American companies, I guess, you know, that what we hear a lot, but also for a lot of the German companies, because actually around 50% of all German companies that are here in the U.S. are manufacturing locations. Mm. So for them, it's really about finding skilled workforce that they're kind of known. You know, they know that from Germany where we have that dual system of education, where you really have a vocational training program in place, where, you know, they just really know they have good skilled workforce for their production site. And this is sometimes here. I mean, I also talked to this one company in North Carolina, actually, and they were looking for electricians. And they got all types of, you know, applications from electricians, and maybe they were people that exchanged light bulbs at an amusement park. But it's not, you know, they have a really highly complicated production line. And if this production line stands still, you really need someone that's more into troubleshooting, problem solving, understanding the entire picture. What is really going on? What is wrong? How do I really fix this complex system? So
yeah, that's an interesting thing. And we've talked about this with other guests where in our in America, it's like go to college. And there's not as much effort in getting vocationally trained and technically trained in specific niche areas like electrical or...
How many people this week wish they were plumbers?
Right, exactly. Right.
Got pipes bursting all over town.
But that in Germany, in your education system, there's tracks for that?
Yes,
that
there are.
You're able to get trained. That way they're trained to handle those kind of complexities.
Yeah, exactly. There is a track, and also it's uniform across all of Germany. So if you did your apprenticeship program with BMW for being an electrician, it would be the exact same program than if you were, you know, at a completely different company in the complete opposite part of the country.
Wow.
So this is also why it's neat, because when people or when companies receive applications from, you know, an electrician and they see that that person went through an apprenticeship program, they know exactly what type of education that person went through.
So. Right. So then their mastery is already assumed if they've completed that program.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Now, do you have advice, like when you're going to Germany and you're talking to companies that maybe haven't explored coming to America yet, how are you going about selling it? Like, is it an easy sell, or is it you got to really kind of twist some arms to get them to consider it?
No, I think, you know, the United States has always been a very important market for German companies. So it's not, it's more, you know, sometimes you have to be Well, a lot of companies also want to go to the U.S., and we don't feel they are prepared yet. So this is one of the things where they really, what I said before, they underestimate the market.
Right.
So for us, it's more about really educating them about being prepared.
Are more people think it's going to be easy to do it, think it's going to be easier?
Yeah.
So you got to kind of manage their expectations and say, look, there's some hurdles here you're not thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a part of your job as well.
Exactly. I mean, we usually say it will take you like 2 to 3 years to break even. And what we hear a lot is, oh, no.
No, you don't understand. My company, we can do it much faster than that.
So tell us a little bit about your personal story. How did you land here? What has been the path to get you to this point?
Yeah, that was really coincidence. I only wanted to stay for a year.
How many years ago was that?
Yeah, it was the grit.
10 years. So grew up in Munich, Germany, and then I spent 2 years in Spain. And then after 2 years in Spain, I thought, okay, maybe an English-speaking country for a change. I'm still young. I don't have to go to Germany yet. So then I found a position with a chamber here in Atlanta, and it was really just a one-year program. I was thinking, okay, 1 year, that's fine. I'll do 1 year USA. And actually, I wanted to go not to the U.S., but...
Sorry.
And then, I don't know, one opportunity led to the other, and then I was asked by our board of directors to, apply for the... for the president CEO position when it became available. That was March of 2012 when I then took over.
Well, I think they made an excellent choice. Tell us about any upcoming events you guys have going on.
Well, we have our big New Year's reception, January 28th. That's here in Atlanta. So that's always a good opportunity to meet with German companies that are already here or, other companies or persons that are involved in the German-American business community. And we do have, since we're responsible for the entire South, we always have one big conference each year that's in a different state each year. And this year it will be on April 7th in Greenville, South Carolina. So that's our big one-day conference for German companies or anyone else about doing business here in the U.S. and where we really also, try and connect all the German companies that are already in our area.
Is there any... place that spotlights German companies where they can come in kind of an expo way where they can so that people know that they exist and then they can do business if they wanted to? Is there anything you do to spotlight individual German companies?
I mean, there is a website, germancompanies.us, where a lot of, that lists a lot of the German subsidiaries that are already in the U.S. Other than that, no, not that
So your role doesn't include any promoting any individual German company. It's just more to serve them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think she's doing a marvelous job of it, don't you? So let me ask about going to these events. Is there some wisdom in and potential opportunity for organizations that are not German organizations but might want to partner with them or do business with them? It makes sense for them to go to these events as well, yes?
Yeah, and we do have that. So because, of course, German companies need law firms or insurance companies. They're doing business here, so they are looking for business partners just like any other company that's on the market.
Sure.
So if an American company wanted to partner with a German company, they could contact your organization and you can be like a matchmaker, or how would that work?
We've also done that in the past where we also had a distributor contact us and they were telling us we're looking for high-end products, that we can distribute. So then we tried to match them up with German companies, so that's also possible.
So how does that work logistically? You just send an email blast out and say, hey,
no.
This is...
first of all, we look, look through the company. We look through what companies do we already know that are here on the U.S. market.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if then companies don't fit, we also have contacts with the German Chambers of Industry and Commerce. They're part of our network, too. So then we, reach out to them. So it's all one network, and that's pretty much how it works, networking.
Sure. Where can we go to learn more?
Our website is gaccsouth.com, so south like north. And this is really, where the contact information for our different staff is, where upcoming events are listed, where information about different states is listed. So that will be your best source of information.
Can you get the results for that German-American Business Outlook survey you did?
Also on our website.
When you go to this website, you're going to be... there is just a ton of...
You're assuming
stuff.
I haven't gone to the website.
I know your predisposition for pre-interview research.
Okay.
am I right? It's a very robust website. Anything you want to know is there. I'm telling you. So go there. So one more time, the website?
GACCSouth.com.
All right. Well, it's been an absolute delight having you in the studio this morning. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
You going to hang with us while we visit with our last
guest? Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
All right. It's the time we've all been waiting for, Lee, the headliner.
All right. It's going to be good.
Absolutely.
A lot of pressure on him.
I know. We have with us managing partner of Cary Street Partners, Mr. Kip Caffey. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I get to share something with you that sometimes people will tell me, what a cool name, Kip Caffey.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I get that sometimes with the Stone Payton thing, but I got to tell you, the Kip Caffey thing, that rivals it pretty well.
Granddad was Kipling, and they named me Kip.
I like it. So tell us a little bit about you and your partners. What are you all up to?
Well, we're sort of an old-fashioned model. We're a regional investment banking and financial advisory firm, wealth management firm. We used to call it brokerage, but we don't really call it that anymore. So if you think of us as a miniature version of a Merrill Lynch, that's a pretty good summation. So we have investment banking on one side and individual advisors that work with individual people, family offices, et cetera, in their managing their financial portfolios toward financial goals.
So now your clients are in high net worth individuals, or are they foundations, or are they a little of everything?
A little bit D, all the above, but the primary target is really individuals and families, and not necessarily high net worth. We certainly have some people that would fall into that category, but a lot of the times we find that you start working with somebody early, and maybe later on they wind up being.
So you're investing in them.
We're investing in them.
They're high net worth at the end of the game.
That's what matters, right?
But I get the idea that your world, your industry has gone through a lot of change over the last few years. Is that accurate?
Our industry has done backflips upon backflips over about the last 12 to 15 years. Most of the changes in the financial services industry are driven by regulatory or legislative change. And the granddaddy of them all was the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the late 90s, which allowed banks to own investment banking and brokerage firms. And so there was massive consolidation that really started when Citibank and Solomon Smith Barney merged. That led to dominoes of every bank trying to acquire an investment banking firm. I'd say the jury is still out on how well that's working
for us, right?
But culturally, it didn't work very well. Most investment banking and brokerage firms were very entrepreneurial in character, which they needed to be successful. Mm-hmm. And by contrast, most banks are not. And they really can't be to be successful in their mission. It's not a criticism. It's an observation of the business that they're in. And so the cultures didn't mesh very well. You had a lot of people decide it wasn't the right fit for them, like me, and go out, strike out.
Were you part of that? And then you said, look, I don't like where this is going. I'm going to go out on my own.
Well, it wasn't so much that I didn't like it. It wasn't the right cultural fit for me.
Right.
But I was at Robinson Humphrey. We were acquired by SunTrust. It's a great organization. I loved my time there. I left on very good terms. But it's a great big company, and that wasn't what I was used to. I was used to a little more nimble entrepreneurial culture, and that's what I preferred. So that's how I wound up at Cary Street.
Well, with the spectrum of clients that you serve, I'm sure that every situation is unique. But are there some patterns, do you find, that maybe across several of those categories that there are one or two concerns that everybody seems to have right now with
Absolutely.
Respect to this? Absolutely.
What we learned in 2008 that we had forgotten was fear. The two great motivators in any market are fear and greed, or any situation are fear and greed. And greed had done a good job, but we'd forgotten about fear, and we got reintroduced to fear. I think there's a place for everyone to have a financial advisor, mostly because you don't think about that stuff every day, and you don't want to. The good news is, again, sort of regulatory changes in the industry over the last 20 years, it's gone from a model that was inherently conflicted. Stone, you really ought to buy 1,000 shares of Apple today. Well, do I really think that he needs 1,000 shares of Apple that he has to buy right this minute, or do I need a commission today?
Right, all right. My kid needs braces.
Right. So there was a conflict in that model, and the model that the industry in general has moved to, and certainly that we follow at Cary Street, is we sit down with you and say, we want to know everything about your family situation. We want to know about your income, how much you save. We want to know if you have an aging parent that's going to require special care, and we need to set up a mechanism to fund that, or if you have a special needs child, or if you want to buy a lake house when you're 65, if you want to retire at 70, whatever. We need to know all these things, and then we need to know what your risk tolerance is. because some people would rather just be in very, very conservative securities, and some people want to take a little more risk, and sometimes we have to say that's a little too much risk given what your goals are. So we take all that and we try to come up with a portfolio that matches that. We don't do individual stocks. We do managers. We say you ought to be 10% in growth stocks and 25% in bonds and 30% in blue chip or whatever it is. And so we'll craft that for you, and then we'll pick managers in each of those categories, and we monitor and see if the managers are performing as we expect them to. And our research department does ongoing research on managers. And if one of them isn't performing, we'll say, hey, we're going to swap that one out and put this manager in. But all that's no cost to you if we make changes, because it's just a fee-based as a percentage of assets under management. So if your assets grow, our fees grow, and that's a good thing. So our interests are aligned with yours as opposed to the old commission model. So that's how we try to sit down and solve people's problems.
How often are you revisiting that? Because things in the marketplace, it seems, change, you know, on a daily basis.
At least quarterly, but certainly if you have a precipitous event, you know, things can change. But the reality is your financial goals are not likely to change dramatically over time. And if we do a good job initially, it ought to be pruning.
So now you're tweaking. You're not, like, dramatically adjusting things.
If the system works, it ought to be tweaking.
Right. And it's all done against this backdrop of what you're trying to accomplish and what you foresee for years ahead, not on what you overheard at the club.
It's a relationship business, not a transactional business. That's right.
But that's not how maybe some of the larger firms are.
Most of the larger firms have migrated toward this over the last 20 years, but you'll still find places where it's much more transactional. Mm-hmm. We don't like that model.
So now what do you say about, like, some of the – you see these commercials where they make it seem like it's as easy, like a baby can do this kind of work, that it's you know, that it's not that hard.
You know, everybody's got to sell their product however they think they should sell it.
I wonder if it wouldn't be hard for a young person to get started in your arena. They may be very driven and very smart, but I'm just thinking, you know, a young person comes to me and, you know, maybe I'm 3-4 times their net worth. And how does a young person get going in your world?
That's a great question.
That was a fantastic question, I thought.
It's a huge problem in the industry. The economic model in the industry has changed. And it's less profitable. The industry is less profitable, particularly at the larger firms, as they've made some changes over the last 20 years that didn't work so well. They used to have massive training programs. All the large firms would hire several hundred trainees every year and take them to New York for 6 weeks at a time and put them up in dorms at NYU or wherever and go through this whole training on how to call somebody on the phone and all about different financial products. And they were really, really good training programs. They've cut those. You know, when your margins start to shrink, you cut costs, and training is usually one of the first costs, which has long-term consequences. So the model is difficult for a young person. You know, I've got a college graduate looking for a job right now, and it's hard to break into this business because it's hard to find the right place to get trained. Generally, the model that people are doing now is partner up with someone older. So you come be my junior partner, for example, and you work with me. Like an apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And over time, you'll begin to take over more and more of our shared customer base. And eventually, when I get to retirement age, you'll take over the whole thing. And so that's the model that people are following. Now, we have that in several of our offices. It works pretty well.
Okay, so that shouldn't necessarily, as an investor, I mean, I'm not a professional investor, but just as someone who's investing money, it shouldn't be a knockout factor for me if a 30-year-old guy calls on me if he's working in the model you described.
Shouldn't be a knockout factor, but you need to understand what the team environment is and who is helping him or her in crafting that portfolio.
Right. It's the model that they're using more than the individual that's kind of delivering that service, right?
I think that's fair. We also try to make sure we have good quality control mechanisms and good resources for any of our financial advisors. If they say, I'm going to meet with Stone, and I know everything about him, and I know his risk profile, but I really need some help in crafting this portfolio, we have a group that does nothing but support people in crafting those portfolios, and they'll even come to the presentation to sit down and go through it with you, so with the financial advisor.
I mean, I could even see some potential advantages in that, because you got the young guy who's full of vim and vinegar going to bust his hump to serve me, but yet he's got the rest of a seasoned team behind him. I mean, I could even build a case for that being an advantage.
I think that's fair, and I think you hit on the right thing. It's about customer service.
Yeah.
Are you staying on top of, if your family's needs change, am I staying on top of that, or is your financial advisor staying on top of that, and then bringing in the right resources to make changes as necessary? It's about customer service and the strength of the relationship at the end of the day.
And to him, my $100,000, that's gold, because he's, I mean, so I like that. There's a lot about that I like. Yeah.
So now, is there anything in the market today that's good, bad, and different? Where, how do you communicate that with your clients?
Overall, our outlook on the market is pretty bullish. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is we do think the economy is recovering. It's continuing to recover at a slow rate. Slower than we'd like to see, but it's pretty steady. The other thing is, quite frankly, the stock market looks great because it looks better than everything else. It looks better than every other asset class. Bonds don't look good because of the, you know, we're going to have a rise in interest rates at some point. And so that's the other reason why the stock market's done so well. It's sort of the only place to put your money.
How's your Bitcoin prognosis? Were you looking on those cyber currencies?
We've stayed away from cyber currency speculation so far.
Now, you guys made a recent acquisition, and it's opened up some opportunity for you in terms of reaching different kinds of markets or capitalizing on different opportunities.
We did. We sat around about 10 years ago and said, the industry has changed. We see a lot of opportunity. All of us came out of regional firms, J.C. Bradford, Robinson Humphrey, Wheat First Securities, Morgan Keegan, sort of the four big regional players in the Southeast, all of which are gone today, part of other organizations. And so we said, gee, we think there's going to be an opportunity to create a regional firm. Mm-hmm. And between us, with all of our various contacts, we sort of know people in the Crescent where those firms did business, which is really sort of from Washington, D.C. down through Texas. And, you know, we speak the language fluently in that part of the world. it seems to us that a geographic strategy and trying to build a regional firm makes some sense. And so far it has. We did an acquisition that we closed last month and picked up a wealth management firm that has offices in Austin and San Antonio, which are two of the fastest growing,
sure,
hottest markets in the U.S. right now. Most importantly, they're really, really good people with the same cultural values that we have in the rest of the firm. At the end of the day, culture is what holds a firm together.
So now, can you talk a little bit about that for our listeners that are business owners that might think about expanding and acquiring a firm? How does that dance go? Like, how do they get on your radar? How do you make the first contact, and how do you build the relationship so you know it's a fit or not?
In this case, we were introduced by a mutual vendor that supports both of us.
So you told this vendor, hey, this is something we're thinking about. If you know anybody that might be interested, and they're having a conversation.
They knew we were looking to grow, and mm-hmm. we were comfortable growing by adding individual advisors or teams of advisors coming over from
right.
other firms, or by acquiring smaller firms. And so they said, hey, there's a company you ought to take a look at. And they made a nice introduction for us to the group in Austin.
So these were complete strangers to you?
We hadn't met them before.
Uh-huh.
So I picked up the phone and called the guy, and we talked for a while. And I said, we'd like to come down and see you. And he said, fine. So we went down and had dinner. You can size up pretty quickly whether or not there's a cultural and personality fit.
Mm-hmm.
And we, by the end of dinner, we knew that there was at least that part. And
right.
if there's not that part, don't waste your time.
Sure.
Culture is very, very important in what we do. And it was very important in each of those four regional firms that I mentioned. That was the glue that held them together and made them successful. So we focus on that. There was obviously a cultural fit. Then it was time to get into the economics and figure out the arithmetic. That was relatively simple.
Cultural fit really was the hard part.
That's the thing we look for first.
So did you kiss a lot of frogs? Were you going out to dinner with other people that maybe you're like, hey, this isn't going to work, and thanks?
We've had a few of those where we didn't think there was a good fit, or where the candidate didn't think there was a good
right.
fit with us, and that's okay. That's okay.
But letting folks know in your immediate sphere of influence that you want them to keep their eyes open and their antenna up, and then having those people recommended in sounds like a good path to
Absolutely.
me. I know you and I always tend to sell better to people we don't know. Why is that? Or don't know us.
I don't know.
So I want to ask about shopping for wealth management services.
Yep.
Because I got to tell you, I don't even, you know, I don't have the kind of pockets Lee has, but I make a decent living, and my wife has like a real job. And, you know, I want to be able to invest money. I don't even know what questions, I don't even know the right questions to ask someone that I might potentially engage as my wealth manager.
That's a pretty good way to start the conversation. I don't even know what questions to ask. You tell me what questions I should be asking you. And if they can't answer that pretty articulately, that's the wrong person. Yeah. You ought to understand their approach, how they're going to relate to you, how they're going to interact with you and your family. How they're going to interact with your other advisors. You probably got some that does your taxes. You probably have some that does your insurance. Yeah. You may have a lawyer that's done your will.
They all got to communicate.
They all got to communicate. But I think you ought to open up, how do you operate? How do you work with clients? Tell me about that and tell me how you would propose to work with me and my family. They ought to have a pretty good answer for that.
Now, you mentioned these other trusted advisors that should be in my circle of influence, right? Who's the quarterback of that?
Well, I think the quarterback is whoever you dictate that it be. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something I always encourage individuals and families to think about is who is quarterbacking? Is it the family attorney who did your will and your estate plan? Is it your financial advisor? We're comfortable in that
so
role.
So sometimes you are the quarterback.
Sometimes we are very much the quarterback.
And then so you're telling the accountant, you know, hey, we're thinking about doing these things, so be aware that this is going to impact their taxes. So, you know. So that way you're proactively addressing these issues instead of having surprises at the end of the fiscal year.
Right. And the worst thing you can have is no quarterback and no communication mm-hmm. across those lines because you may find out that you're working at cross purposes.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier in the conversation, you generally felt like virtually everyone should and could have a wealth manager. I mean, they don't necessarily have to, you know, run an entire company like Armstead here or be, you know, deep pockets like Lee. Joe Sixpack, who's just going to work for a living, should have someone helping him or her manage their money, right?
I think so.
You're open to conversations with anybody?
Yeah.
And I think the question that we all want to ask is, what's your continuity plan?
Armistead and I are going to talk later.
But in your industry, it's regulated, so those are some of the things that you have to be aware of, right?
Yes, and we do have a binder, but Armistead and I are going to talk.
All right, you're welcome for that, Armistead. Just trying to help you. You're wingman here.
This segment brought to you by Preparis.
So now, the best way if somebody wanted to learn more about what you guys are up to?
Start at the website. It's pretty robust. I can say that because we didn't do it. We had a terrific outside firm do it for us. And it's carrystreetpartners.com, C-A-R-Y.
And then that'll give you just general information about wealth management as well as your – it seems like, you know, it's important for you guys to work with clients that are aligned philosophically with you just like it is with your financial
Absolutely.
Partners.
Absolutely. There's good information about our wealth management business as well as our investment banking services. So it's a good place to start. And believe me, lots of places where you can click contact us. On there.
All right. That's Carrie, C-A-R-Y, streetpartners.com.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the
show
today. All right, we will see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.